I, Harry S. Truman, President of the United States, dedicate this day of Sunday to America, firm and free.
If you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I am a minute man. I am the guardian of America, armed and free. For we knew it will always be the citizen who is the guardian of America, armed and free.
Welcome to America Armed and Free, a program dedicated to preserving your God-granted, constitutionally guaranteed individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or state, understanding that the citizens are the militia. This program is produced by Charles Heller and is not endorsed by anyone who isn't pro-choice on freedom.
We are the guardians of America, armed and free.
We are indeed the guardians of America, armed and free. And every now and then, there's something so important that we go off the topic a little bit, and we do something that's related to, but is not directly on the topic of right to keep and bear arms. Such is the case today, because we have in studio Sidney Sevek Finkel. He's a child Holocaust survivor, and he's told his story of survival in over 120 schools, serving thousands of students. After being encouraged by numerous students, teachers, and administrator, Finkel wrote Sevek and the Holocaust, The Boy Who Refused to Die. If you or your school would like to consider adopting Sevek the Holocaust as a text for your students, you may request a complimentary review copy, and I'll give the address later here in the program. But it is a joy, a privilege, and an honor to have in the studio with us Sidney Sevek Finkel. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and happy to be here.
I'm so glad you could join us, because it's so important today that people understand not only what the Holocaust was, but some of the things that led up to it. And there are people like the current leader in Iran, who would like to tell you that it didn't happen. And you lived through it. You are a living testament to the fact, not only that it did, but what exactly how it happened. For instance, you were, as I read your book, you were at Bergen-Belsen. Is that correct?
Buchenwald.
Why did I get? Oh, one of your relatives was sent to Bergen-Belsen.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I've confused that. But you were at Buchenwald. Now, they didn't have gas chambers at Buchenwald, did?
No, they didn't have gas chambers.
They had ovens.
They had ovens to burn the corpses, and there was like fire coming out of the chimney. I had no idea what it was, but it was very frightening, and on it was supposedly written that the only way out of it was through that chimney.
And did you ever, have you ever gone back to look at it and see if that truly was on there, or?
No, I have never been back. I haven't been back in Germany or in Poland. I just, too painful to anticipate a visit like that.
I understand that. You know, one of the things you mentioned in your book, and the book is excellent, folks. It's short. It's about 103 pages, but it's called Sevek and the Holocaust, The Boy Who Refused to Die by Sidney Finkel. One of the things you talked about was going to visit the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Can you tell us about your experience of that?
Sure. Up to that point, I kept quiet. My experiences were quiet. It was a secret within myself. And I didn't even tell my children about it. But when the Holocaust Museum in Washington opened up, I went downtown to see my daughter, who was pregnant, and I told her a little bit of my story. And she insisted that we all go as a family to the Holocaust Museum. And going to that museum and seeing all the exhibits, especially the railroad car, that was the instrument in so much murder that it just opened me up, and I was able to tell my children about my experience, and there was a flood of emotion that came out. And so this, to me, the museum represents like the grave, you know, the cemetery for my parents who perished.
You know, I've been through that railroad car, and when you step through, it's open on both sides, so that part of the display. It's an interesting building. It's 5 stories tall. You take the elevator to the top, and then you walk down a series of concourses to walk through the various displays. And one of the things you do is you walk up on like a loading dock, and you walk through this car. And when you walk through this car, you cannot imagine. I'm a generation after you, and it's overwhelming. It was overwhelming to me to walk through it. I could not comprehend how one part of the human race could be so cruel to another part of its very same race. How could that ever have happened?
Well, that's what hatred comes, and we were also completely defenseless. There was no way to protect ourselves. There was no allies. We're just totally helpless.
One of the things, and there's even a promotion about this in the next break that's coming up. It's from a group called, I don't know if you've heard of it or not, it's called Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, JPFO. It's run by a man by the name of Aaron Zellman out of Wisconsin.
No, I never heard of it.
But one of the things that organizations like it point out was that there were a series of laws in Germany over a period of years. It wasn't just the Nazis. It was actually before they came to power, that had pretty much had registered all the firearms in Germany and made them subject to confiscation. And then in 1933 and subsequent to actually the 1938 Nazi Weapons Act, made it illegal for Jews to own guns.
That's true. It's absolutely true. No, there are, especially I come from Poland, and in Poland nobody had arms. They're far too expensive, for one thing. But it's also the Jewish culture was nonviolent, and guns are perceived as being a violent action that was more prevalent among the Christian people than the Jewish people.
But that's changed now. If you look at the attitude about arms in Israel, that attitude does not exist anymore because of the and it's in a two-word phrase, never again.
You know, I talked to a friend of mine who is pro arms, and he said, "You're a Holocaust survivor. How can you not be pro arms?" And I kind of never thought about that like before, but I can just imagine if there was just a few thousand revolvers or something among the things. But it's not about the guns, I think. It's about the attitude. The attitude has to be the first. And the attitude was such as more passive. And that's one of the great tragedies of the Holocaust, is that for most of the experiences, the people were passive and were eager to follow, not eager, but, you know, they were just following, like, was God's will, and there was nothing. It's only when the older people were sent away to death camps and the young worked, because the young were saved more because they were workers, that the attitude changed and there was more of an aggressive policy.
If you look at the Warsaw Uprising, there were 22 young men who had between them at the beginning 9 guns. And for 40 days, they held off the Waffen-SS until finally the only way to overcome these 22 young men was to burn the entire thing to the ground.
It's really amazing, isn't it? Because it took the Germans only 30 days to defeat the whole Polish army, and the ghetto resistance lasted almost 3 months.
Yeah. And there ought to be a book about that called 22 Angry Jews.
I don't know if there's one at that title, but there are a lot of books about the Warsaw Resistance.
There are, and it's so important. And, you know, people think, well, gee, what could one man with a... You said, you know, if there only had been, what was your phrase, 1,000 revolvers?
Yeah.
And you think about that, and you bring it into the modern context. If there had been 4 revolvers, they could have been 100 years old and still worked on board those 4 airliners, September 11th would not have been the disaster that it was. If there had been 1,000 revolvers that people could have used in resistance, you know, the Soviet, Gulag Archipelago, the man who wrote that,
Help. Shostakov. It's
no. Solzhenitsyn. Alexander mm-hmm. Solzhenitsyn. And Solzhenitsyn commented on the Holocaust that he said that if every SS team that had gone to the home of a Jew had been met by a hail of gunfire, he said he doubted whether the Holocaust would have happened. Do you believe that that's true?
I'm not sure. I kind of doubt it because the Germans were so well organized and they had overpowering arms, and I don't know if that, but it would make a difference. The Nazis would have been more respectful of the Jewish population, and they would be much more afraid to start these things when they knew that there was going to be resistance. That was lacking. But again, it's the philosophy and attitude of the Jewish people that was more responsible for that than the lack of arms.
Why did it come to be that way? Why did we, I'm a member of the tribe too, how did we get to be that way?
Well, we were always persecuted, just about through our whole history, made to feel that we were less than, and people that are less than don't have a right to defend themselves. I think that's a good reason, you know, for that. Also, it's the teaching of the, well, maybe not. I was going to say it's the teaching of the Torah, but more passivity. But this has totally changed. You know, this is the state of Israel, which of course is a modern state with arms and an air force and a navy. And this is wonderful for somebody like I, when I first went to Israel, seeing Jewish soldiers, you know, carrying machine guns. That was so satisfied because we were so totally powerless.
All right. Well, we're up on that first bottom of the hour break. Bear with us.
Isn't a government where only the police and military are armed a police state? The only way that can happen is gun control through the ruse of for the children. But in police states, children are murdered because parents can't shoot back. If gun control is for the children, how much did it benefit the Jewish and Gypsy children of World War II Germany? Think it can't happen here? Think again. Hitler was democratically elected. Brought to you by Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, jpfo.org.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
And welcome back to America Armed and Free, to the sound of Exodus and some music I thought would be somewhat appropriate. We have the joy and pleasure and honor of having with us in studio Sidney Finkel. He is a Holocaust survivor. He was a child survivor of the Holocaust, and a fascinating story. The book is called Sevek and the Holocaust, The Boy Who Refused to Die. Now, can you tell us about your experience in the Polish ghetto? Whoops, let me turn your microphone on. That would be better. And try it now. Yeah. Can you tell me something?
I happened to be in a town called Piotrków Trybunalski, and the Germans made that into a ghetto only 2 weeks after they arrived. It was actually the first ghetto in Poland, and when all the Jews were forced to go into the ghetto, which was like a mile square. And at that point, we lost all of our freedom. We were just basically just slaves, all our possessions, everything. And the rules were changed every day. And there was no school for children. We were not allowed to leave the ghetto. Eventually, it was fenced in. The food supply was very low, and there was a lot of hunger. There was also a lack of fuel in the wintertime. There was no room for all of the people that they kept pushing into the ghetto, so that people had to live in the side of the buildings, in the streets, young children, and also most of the time very, very hungry. So we're just about like a cattle that were inside a cage, and the only way actually we survived is if you were lucky enough to have hidden some jewelry or some valuables, you can exchange those for food. And my family had a few of those things, and they had connection with the Polish Christian people, my father having been in business. So we were luckier than most, because we were able to get food, so we were not as starving as the rest of the population were. But there was a sense of being in prison. Everything, life as we knew it, ceased to exist. And also the anxiety, total anxiety of what was going to happen to us, especially when we're beginning to see that further south of us, where there were other ghettos, the Germans brought in the trains, the cattle car trains, and the whole population of these ghettos was emptied out and pushed into these cattle cars. And we didn't know where they were going. We were told by the Nazis that where they were going would be a work camp. But then we heard rumors that where they were going was really an extermination camp, where everybody in, on these trains was being gassed. But, human nature being what it is, we couldn't bring ourselves to believe that that was true. So we thought it was just exaggerated, and they were trying to frighten us, the people who would tell us those tales. But eventually we found out that these trains were death camps. They were sent to a place called Treblinka. And, they were unloaded quickly. The women were made to shave their hair. Hair was shaved, and they were given a towel and soap and the impression that they were going to take a shower. And instead, gas came down, and people just suffocated because of lack of air that they could breathe. And it was just, so in my case, in my hometown, 95% of the population, including my mother and sister, they were gassed in this place called Treblinka.
Hmm. At what point did it become clear to the population who were imprisoned that they truly were death camps? Was that by 1943 people realized
it? Well, it was October of 1942 when the deportations began, and just about then it became clear, late 42, 43, that those indeed drivers of these trains and other people who escaped would come back, and they would tell us. But still, there was still a disbelief, because the Germans were the most civilized nation in Europe, and we just couldn't bring ourselves to believe that the Germans would do anything like that. It didn't make even economic sense, because we could be put to work in German war efforts, and so why would they want to kill us? But the hatred was so great on their part, the Jewish people had to be eliminated, totally eliminated. There was no exception. No matter whether you were a Freud or just somebody like me, it didn't make a difference. If you were Jewish, you had no right to live.
Where did that hatred come from?
It came centuries of hatred. It was being persecuted through centuries, and having a different culture and different beliefs and a different religion. The Jewish people would stuck to their traditions. They would not accept the newer religions, and therefore it developed like a minority that would be blamed for all the, in Poland they were blamed for all the diseases that happened, like cholera. Today swine flu would have been blamed on the Jews.
Yeah, but they couldn't blame it on those of us who keep kosher. I'm trying to make light of it.
Yeah.
You can't. There's no way to. Tell us about what happened to your sister, Rania.
My sister, Rania, was pregnant, and we didn't know how to save her from going onto those trains. So a wonderful Polish Catholic lady by the name of Nova came into the ghetto, and they said for us to smuggle her out, and she would make arrangements for her to be put into a Polish Catholic hospital and signed in as a Catholic. So that's what happened. She gave birth to a little boy, but somebody, some Polish person in that hospital, went to the German security police and told them that there was a Jew there pretending to be a Catholic. So they came to the hospital, they picked up the infant, and they opened the window and they threw him out. And then they took my sister to the Jewish cemetery where they shot her.
I understand from your book that they tried to keep that from you for a while, but eventually you found out.
Right. They were, you know, they loved me and they wanted to protect me, and they did. That's why I owe my life to is my family. It wasn't my own smartness that helped me to survive. But I met her husband in the ghetto, and he was all distraught. And when I heard this thing from him, I ran to my house and I crawled underneath the bed, and I just cried and cried. Nobody could console me. And the strange thing is, in the future, horrendous thing was going to happen to me. And I wanted to cry desperately, but you know, I couldn't bring any tears. To this day, I can't cry very much.
Maybe when you get to a point where you've seen so much that it's overwhelming, there isn't anything left.
Well, in order to survive, that's one of the terrible casualties of the war, was that you stripped yourself of human values. You just became concentrated strictly on surviving. You gave up the humanity that you had and really didn't care about people except just you. And how they turned us into animals, you know, and turned me into an animal. There's a passage in the book where I meet my father, and I don't want to be with him, you know, turn my back on him. And this is a person that I love more than anything else in the world.
Folks, if you'd like to call in, the number is 790-2040, or if you're in Arizona but away from Tucson, 866-725-5467. And to ask Mr. Finkelstein, ask Sidney Finkelstein anything you want about his experience of the Holocaust or the lessons gleaned from it. This is a good time. We're almost at our bottom of the hour break. I guess, was there some sense, Sid, was there some sense in the ghetto before everyone was shipped out that, when you said you didn't want to believe that it was true, was there some sense that people were almost sort of, shall we say, whistling past the graveyard? They thought it was true, but they forced themselves to, in other words, they denied reality as a survival mechanism?
Definitely, but they have good experience to go by because, especially in Poland, persecution was rampant against the Jews, and we survived centuries of other oppression. And think we're always able to like negotiate with our oppressors and bribe them and do things like that, but nobody ever imagined that this would be different. That this was what they meant to do, is to destroy everyone. That's something that just couldn't accept. There was no precedent for it. No time in history has ever a whole people been wiped out without any exceptions or anything, just for the fact that you were born a Jew.
What do you say to the people who either deny that it happened or deny that the level of it was what it was? I mean, having lived through it, what do you tell people like that?
Well, there isn't much. It's very sad and makes me very angry, but there's nothing that you can tell them because they won't listen. Their minds are set, and I think it's an excuse for hating, continue having the liberty to keep on hating. There are people who hate the anti-Semites, and they really are Nazis, in my mind.
How have you avoided having a similar emotion to the people who did what they did to you and your family? How have you avoided the hate for yourself?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that I did, because you kind of associate with the oppressor, and I went through a phase like that, and there was also consequences. Like, you know, I tell kids in my talks is that, you know, it's not about the starvation, it's not about beating, it's the emotional effect that is left with you that you bear all your life, and you just cope with it the best you can. It's not much different than the troops that return from Iraq or Afghanistan, really. Post-traumatic syndrome is very strong.
But for a far different reason.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Because I don't perceive us as being the oppressor, even in countries we invade. We don't, you know, we don't do the things. We try so hard not to injure innocent people as part of the American way. And certainly, innocent people do get killed, and it's a war that happens. But we try so hard, and when it both angers and saddens me that people think, when you hear the phony numbers about Iraq, that 100,000 civilians got killed and wantonly by America. That's just not the country I know.
That's very true, because the American Army, the liberators, they were the most wonderful people, young men, and everybody wanted to be on the American side. Nobody wanted to be on the Russian side. They risked their lives to come over because the GIs, they were very kind, and they were wonderful young men, for most part.
Well, stand by for just a little bit. We're at that bottom of the hour break, and we'll be back in just a little bit on America Armed and Free with Sidney Finkel of the book Sebek and the Holocaust, The Boy Who Refused to Die.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
Welcome back to America Armed and Free, a very different episode of it this week with Sidney Finkel in studio with us, and his book is Sebek and the Holocaust, The Boy Who Refused to Die. There's a fascinating part in your book about what's called Block 66. I believe that was at Buchenwald, was it not?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about Block 66?
That was a block where all the young people stayed, and the way it happened that there was a resistance movement, underground resistance movement in Buchenwald. And when the young people arrived in Buchenwald almost at the end of the war, the Germans were really surprised there were still youngsters alive. You know, they were kind of took a they didn't do their job because they were still young children. And this underground movement organized us and was able to put us into a separate camp. And they would put signs on that those huts were affected by typhus, so the Nazis would be afraid to go in there. And they gave us encouragement, were able to give us better food. We learned to sing songs and lifted our spirit. And for the first time, we kind of believed that maybe we could survive this thing.
Hmm. What was the sort of strange system of justice there?
It was like for my hometown, there were probably call them revenge groups. The people who collaborated with the Nazis were could be strangled at the night, and the Germans, of course, didn't care if Jews killed each other. And also, it was at that point there was very strict disciplinarian affairs, like in Buchenwald. It was mostly run by political Germans who turned against Hitler. But towards the end of the war, the whole system broke down. And talking about denial, I have actually an index sheet where I'm interviewed, not interviewed, but where all my statistics and everything I put on a sheet, I have that with me. A historian was able to pull it out from the archives.
A sheet of?
Like an index sheet when I came in, my name.
Oh, they were able to find the records of the
Yeah, where I came from, the number that they gave me.
Yes,
and that
started.
Was the only thing that I had. I had no name. I just had the number.
Started with 127. I remember that.
Yeah.
All right. To the phones. And Tom, you're live on America Armed and Free with Sidney Finkel. Your comment or question?
Yeah, Mr. Finkel.
Can you hear him okay?
Hello? I can hear you,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm very moved by your testimony, and it troubles me greatly. And I'm just wanting to know if there's, you know, we're talking about historical parallels earlier, and I was just wondering if there was, you could see any historical parallel with abortion going on in America?
That's an interesting question. Do you see any parallel at all between the two?
I can't think of any, sorry.
Okay. And do you have any follow-up, Tom?
Yeah, to me it's very, very parallel in that we see an innocent people group that are despised, made to be inhuman, or
but it's not based on a religion and eliminating people that already exist. I respect your point of view, but that's not what the topic of this interview is, and so we're going to move on from there. And hi, you're live on America Armed and Free. Your first name, please.
Robert.
Robert, you're on the air with Sidney Finkel. Your comment or question, please.
Mr. Finkel, speaking of parallels, can you draw any parallels about what you learned insofar as how the Jews should best conduct themselves for survival in present-day Israel? I have the opportunity to witness that dreadful wall that's been put up. And not only has the wall been put up conveniently in somebody else's country, but there's about 1,000 yards on each side of it that is a no-man's land. And it just seems to me that it generates old animosities and could very well be regarded as oppressing another sort of people.
Okay. I'd like to hear...
Well, the wall was put up not because it's going to improve the scenery, it's going to stop suicide bombers. And we are doing everything we can in Iraq and Afghanistan to stop suicide bombers. So if there were no suicide bombers and the Arabs weren't determined to destroy the Jewish people and throw them into the sea, then there would be no need for wall. It's just one of the defensive measures so that people can live with some peace.
The operative difference there is that there's one wall and it's straight, as opposed to four and being in a more or less of a square with ovens in the middle of them. That's the difference between how the Jews treat the Palestinians and how the Nazis treated the Jews, if you want to complete the thought. How did you learn to trust against it?
It took a long time. It took many, many years. And I think that my wife helped me enormously. And then my family. I've been in psychotherapy for sometimes, I think, as long as 15 years or more. Suffered from post-traumatic stress, depression. I'm on medication, have been for a very long time. But throughout the whole thing, I learn to be more human and to relate to people and to feel other people's pain. But it's a process that still goes on.
Hmm. tell us about that. Speaking of that, your wife's help, and also of other people. Tell us about the process of coming out of Germany and out and into England. You went to a very special school there, and then the process of becoming an American.
When I got to this boarding school, which was a very high class type of a school, very bright students. I had a second grade education. I could just barely read and write Polish, so it was extremely difficult for me to catch up. But more important was that my social skills was zero. I didn't know how to get along with other so-called normal kids, so I would erupt in anger and fights and destructive things like that. But the teachers in that school were so absolutely dedicated and loving. They loved me until I could love myself. And that was the best medicine I could ever have. They really restored me to some kind of a mental health. What was the other part?
About acts of kindness by various people. Some of the people who put you up or in England, some of the...
Oh, yes. The Jewish refugee committee that brought us over from Czechoslovakia to England, they sent me to school. They paid for everything. After I done with school, they helped me with lodgings and education and things of that type. So I owe a lot to the English Jewish community.
What made you decide not to go to Israel and come to the United States?
There was a lot of people made the choice to go to Israel, but I had this bigger brother who was 17 years older than I, and I just, whatever he decided, that's where I would go. He felt that we were so tired, and we just felt so much discomfort and pain that we didn't want to go to a country that was in strife, and that we deserved a little bit of a normalcy. But again, that was my brother's decision. If he had decided to go to Israel, that's where we would have gone.
And tell us about coming to the U.S. When did you come to the United States? And you're a citizen now, so...
Right. Yeah. I had an uncle in Chicago, and it took 4 years for me to get a visa. He had to testify and send papers that would not be a burden to the state. So one day I got a call to come in to the American Embassy in London, and I was interviewed by an officer there, and he asked me if that was the 50s, and he asked me if I was a communist, and of course I was ready to burn up the Soviet Embassy, prove that I wasn't, you know. And when I got my visa, it was one
might
of the...
Might have been a good investment. You got your visa, I'm sorry.
When I got my visa, it was one of the happiest days. I actually ran on the streets of London shouting out that I was coming to America. So it was worse than... I love America, and I would defend it with my life.
All right, stand by. We're up on the last break of the hour, and we'll be back in just a little bit with... Sidney Finkel of the book Sevek, and the Holocaust, The Boy Who Refused to Die. It's excellent. It's a very short book, 103 pages, but wow, it's a life changer. And I recommend you get it, folks. And we're going to have this last break.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
Used to sing that in Hebrew school. Wonderful song. Welcome back. Last segment of America Armed and Free with Sidney Finkel. And folks, if you have any questions, it's a great time to call in and ask them. It's 520-790-2040. Or if you're in Arizona but away from Tucson, 866-725-5467. You know, the caller Robert asked a question. He meant to be kind of harsh about the way he did it. And I like to use people's harshness as a teaching point. Can you describe, you've been to Israel, you've seen the situation, how does Israel treat people not of the same faith, and contrast that with how in Europe people treated
You can also ask the question, how do the Arab countries treat the Jewish minority that was pretty large, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and they were all thrown out?
Yeah, I wonder how Saudi Arabia would treat a copy of the Torah.
Or any one of those. First of all, there's a large Arab minority in Israel. I mean, it's huge, probably about 30% of the population. And they have totally equal rights with the Jewish population. I think the one exception is that they don't have to serve in the armed forces.
There's a little bit different rules for land ownership, too, are there not?
I'm not aware of that.
I thought there were. I could be wrong.
I'm not aware of that, but they have every right, and this is, and all other minorities are respected. The religious properties, the things that mean a lot to Christians and Muslims, and they are protected. They're totally protected. They're accessible to everybody. It's a democracy. There's a big only democracy in the Middle East, and the Jewish people, all they wanted to do is to live. If you give them a chance at peace, they can contribute and do contribute tremendously to the world's good being.
Yeah. No one's ever really heard of a Jewish jihad.
There are no Jewish, there are a few nasty Jews, but very few, but nobody nobody is a suicide bomber.
Right. Yeah, we're more like to try and sue people into submission than
yeah.
to shoot them.
Right.
How were you accepted in America? Tell us about, you know, when you came here.
I've been accepted wonderfully. You know, I was prior to that, I was in England for 6 years, and the English people were great to me, but always felt like you were a foreigner. But in America, I felt totally free, able to express myself. I have never had any adverse effect while being in America, and that's the truth.
Hmm. And when you first came to America, and you worked for one company for 40 years, right?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. And then retired from that. So, how would you tell people who listen to your story and they want to be hateful towards others, either as a response to the way to the Holocaust? And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't just the Jewish people. There were 6 million others that were gassed and didn't survive the concentration camps. So you're not, the way I see it, you're not just talking about religious persecution, but hatred in general. Right. How do you get people to turn away from that hatred? How do you do that?
Well, it starts with me, because I used to feel a great deal of hatred for the Germans. I was ready to be a suicide bomber. If they had the right organization, they could have probably recruited me. I had so much hate within me. And when I began my career of telling my story at schools, I slowly realized that this anger that I had inside of me was eating me up. And I had a hard time enjoying the blessings that I had in my life. You know, 8 grandchildren, 5 children, you know, a wonderful wife, good job. And I decided that there was absolutely a need, in order to set myself free, to actually totally forgive the Germans and the Nazis. That only by forgiveness and love could I set myself free. And that's what I'm trying to do. It's not, I don't do it perfectly, but I do forgive them. And that's to me, that's the essence of hatred destroys. Hmm. It destroys the person who feels the hatred.
Yeah, it's Paul Harvey always used to say that the person who gives flowers is the person who gets to enjoy them first. And unfortunately, the negative side of that is true in reverse. That the person who hates destroys themselves first as they attempt to destroy the object of their hatred. That said, sometimes some of the best friends of Israel, at least in the United States, are the Christian right. And sometimes people of the Jewish faith tend to be on the left, and the left doesn't support Israel to the extent that in many cases the right does. Do you have any reason or explanation or feeling for why that might be? That sometimes the fundamentalist Christians are more offended of the Jews than some of the Jews are?
We love their support and we're really grateful to it, but we also are suspicious of a little bit, because they're doing it for theological reasons, verses in the Bible and things that, something to the effect that Jews have to first come back to the land in order for Christ to come back. But like I said, we love their support, and I have come across Christian people, what we call, some people call right. fundamentalists. I was in Cabot, Arkansas. It was like a second home for me. Every year I would go over there and speak to the class, and they would... the whole community turned out, and they planted a garden for me, called it a Civic Survival Garden, and it was just wonderful how these people who go to church on Wednesdays and Sunday, what a wonderful human beings they are.
They're probably better with Wednesdays and Sundays than we are on Saturdays with the tefillin.
Oh, yeah. they're okay. They're good people, and they're Americans. I think most Americans are good people.
Yeah. It just seems to me that the lessons that you present, not only in your book, Sevek and the Holocaust, The Boy Who Refused to Die, but the lessons seem to me to be so clear about what hatred brings. And yet at the same time, there's people that are willing to use anything they can to get a political gain and put that over the value of humans. And I don't care whether it's left or right, and I don't understand that separation. I don't understand how people can be so separated from who they are.
I think it's a really tragic, because people are human beings. We all Americans, and the fact that Americans can hate each other because of, and the difference in our political beliefs is not all that great. It really isn't all that great.
Not by comparison to what you went through.
Yeah, but I'm grateful for the American institutions that keep a balance, and we don't go to the extreme of vilifying people to the point where you would want to create, political assassinations and things like that. We're much better than other countries are in that respect, and we got to be civil to each other, because it's a very balanced line. You go over that line and you lose it.
Sid, it's been wonderful having you on. It's a very nice departure from talking about guns for an hour, and I'm so glad you shared your experience with us. And folks, the book once again is Sevek and the Holocaust, The Boy Who Refused to Die by Sidney Finkel. It's available at all Amazon and anywhere else people want to get it.
It's Amazon.
It's available on Amazon. It's only about 103 pages, and it's worth reading. It'll tell you a lot. And there's the theme music, so I want to encourage each and every one of you to be vigorous, not violent, be vigilant, not vituperative, in liberty. And with great thanks to Sid for sharing his story and to the family that supports him, I'm Charles Heller.